Welcome back to It's a New Day here at 1180 WFYL, 5 minutes past the hour. It is Wednesday, the fourth day of February. And again, as I said, it's about 6 minutes past the hour. As we've been previewing for you our whole show, pretty much, we have two very special guests in our studio at the moment. I'm going to pass things off to Susan, who's going to give us a little rundown of what's going on. Susan?
Thank you, Andrew. Indeed, we do. We're delighted to have two very special guests with us this morning. Irene Mazur is from Huntington Valley. She and her husband are both trained and attorneys. Irene is not practicing right now. She is devoting her time to work regarding Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, helping them. At present, she is the director of advocacy and information program of the Ukrainian Federation of America. Now, our other guest is Roman Andrejczyk, a neighbor right here in West Norriton, an authority on Ukraine. He is a Ukrainian-American citizen with a marvelously varied background, a very accomplished person. Both of them have a wealth of information to share with us today about Ukraine. We're so glad to have you. We welcome you. Thank you very much. I would like to start with you, Roman. This morning we were reading in Romans, "Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." You have in your background people who ran that race and are an inspiration to you, and I know will be an inspiration to our listeners. I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about that.
Sure. First of all, I want to take the opportunity to thank you very much for inviting us and for us to be able to share with you what we know, the knowledge in terms of what's going on in the world, especially in Ukraine. Just very briefly, I was born in Ukraine. My parents left when I was 3 years old. I grew up, most of my life I spent in the United States. I went to college at Penn State and spent a good part of my life working for aerospace industry and the U.S. military, a total of 26 years in the Army, and I'm retired, both reserve and active duty. My grand-grandparents on both sides and my grandparents on both sides, my grandfathers, were Catholic priests. In Ukraine, the Catholic priests are allowed to be married prior to being ordained. One of the things I want to bring up especially is my father's father was arrested for being a Ukrainian Catholic priest, and a patriot of Ukraine, was tortured and executed. So this is the problem we always had, having Russia as a neighbor for hundreds of years, and it's still continuing today. Thank you.
I just might add here that Roman is a retired colonel in the U.S. military and basically went through Army warfare school and very accomplished gentleman.
And Roman, we thank you for that service as well.
Yes, we do. Thank you, Roman, very much. We know you also worked with Lockheed Martin and General Electric.
Yes,
I think for
did.
Many years
yes,
you've had quite an accomplished
industry.
Career.
Right.
But that's not really the reason you're here today. You wanted to share with us about Ukrainian situation. Irene, I'd like to turn the microphone over to you and let you tell the listeners a little bit about your work for Ukraine right now.
Well, thank you, Susan. Thank you for inviting me here. It's a great honor to be here and to talk actually to my fellow Americans to about the real situation of what is going on in Ukraine. I was born in Ukraine and immigrated into the United States about 14 years ago. I became a United States citizen, went to Temple Law School, graduated. As you correctly stated, I work closely with the Ukrainian community, specifically with Ukrainian nonprofit organizations such as Ukrainian Federation of America, New Ukrainian Wave, Association of Ukrainians Abroad called Razum. It's a new organization. I work between the Ukrainian mission at the UN, Ukrainian embassy, and our New York General Consul General. We combine our efforts in the struggle against that Russian aggression. I am actually really happy to be here today because this is a chance for me to actually provide it really detailed information to regular people, what is going on in Ukraine, not simply what is written in the newspapers, what is written in all those reports, but perhaps I would give you some examples what I experience in conversations with, when I talk with other people, with volunteers in Ukraine, with people who are actually having firsthand knowledge about what is going on.
Absolutely. So just to give a little background of, you know, what's been going on, this isn't the first kind of, you know, as you mentioned, Roman, you know, there's been, you mentioned having Russia as a neighbor for 100 years. You know, this is the kind of things that you have seen. And we can go back as far as 1992 when we have, you know, talking about Moldova, Chechnya, 94 through 96. Georgia, I think most people remember, almost removed Russia from the Olympics that year. And I think that was the big story there, but it wasn't necessarily what was going on in Georgia. I remember watching reporters on the ground in Georgia talking, you know, doing interviews with gunfire in the background. And that was, you know, when I was in high school. And then just as recently as 2014, when the annex of Crimea. So this is not something that is new. However, it is something that has fallen out of the world view, as you mentioned. I mean, you know, it's something, or at least in our American media, it's not something that is heavily talked about every day. And we want to make that change.
Well, can I respond to this
question? Sure, absolutely.
Well, actually, it's good that you noticed from the standpoint of modern history. However, we have a long time, 100 years of history of Russian aggression, suppression of Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian traditions. The most horrible example of that suppression, we had three genocides in 20s, in 30s, and after the Second Great War. Millions of Ukrainians, it is estimated that about 12 million Ukrainians were starved to death. And it was the most horrible tragedy of the 20th century. It is still not recognized by the entire world as a genocide. However, United States did recognize it as a genocide against Ukrainian nation. If you look into the modern history, yes, unfortunately, Russia is not the best neighboring country to have. And the policy that they engage actually shows that they really would like to resurrect the style and regime of Soviet Union as it was before. And if you would look into the invasion of Georgia in 2008, you could actually see that Russia pulled the same trick which they pulled, which they are pulling in Ukraine right now. Mm. They under the false pretext that Russian-speaking population of Georgia are persecuted by Georgian government, Russia moved their troops. However, Georgians, they didn't have enough, I would say, patience, and they responded into Russian provocations with military force, which allowed Russia to move their troops in, which what distinguished Ukraine in the struggle with Russia during 2014, Ukraine was actually holding off because we didn't want, Ukraine didn't want to repeat Georgian mistake. Mm. Some people criticize Ukrainian government that they were not proactive enough into defending invasion of Crimea and moving Russian troops into the eastern provinces. But Ukraine wanted to show that there is that Ukraine stands for democracy, for peaceful resolutions. Unfortunately, such decisions were paid by human lives, but Ukrainian government wanted to show that they do not go to the level of the Russian politics.
I think that's a very interesting point, because I don't think that's a narrative that is has arrived in the U.S. media. You know, it is seen as an overtaking rather than a steadfast resolution. Roman, your thoughts on that? We've got about 2 minutes before we head to commercial break, but
sure.
we'll be able to talk about this more.
I just want to add a little bit more to that. Prior to Georgia, as you know, Russia has about 10,000 troops or so in Transnistria, which is in Moldova. Mm. And they have had those troops for a long time, also with the pretense that there is a Russian population or Russian-speaking population that really want to be Russians and so forth. So strategically, if you look at the map, what they're doing right now with Crimea, where they're there in Moldova, where they are in Georgia, and what they're trying to do is create a corridor through Mariupol, which is heard in the news about a week or so ago, bombardment killing a lot of innocent people. They're trying to create a corridor around the Black Sea. Mm. They would control good portion of it, all the way, even the Romanians are already worried about that, and the Bulgarians. If you look at the map, you'll see that.
And I think what most people understand, that corridor is kind of like a pincer movement, right?
That's,
if you can imagine your fingers going to grab something, you move around the edges to get a front, and then you move backwards through. And that would place Ukrainians right in the crosshairs of what they're trying to do. We have a lot more to discuss. We definitely want to keep talking about this. So we do have to head to a commercial break. When we get back, we'll be talking more with Irene and Roman about what can be done, what is still happening, a little bit more details, maybe some facts about Ukrainians in the U.S. as well. So as I said, we will be right back. So stay right there. You definitely don't want to miss the rest of what we're talking about today. So stay right there. Welcome back to It's a New Day here at 1180 WFYL. We are truly blessed to have such a wonderful interview in our studio at the moment. We are talking to Roman and Irene here. They are experts on what is going on in Ukraine at the moment. And even, I would say, as Irene pointed out and Roman pointed out in the first segment, modern history as well as a little bit further back than that as well, of all things that have happened between Russia and Ukraine in recent history, as well as, as I mentioned, further back from that. So let's dive into a little bit more of, what is exactly happening right now. We mentioned a little bit of some of the tactics that are being used. And Roman, maybe I'll direct this question at you first. But this, I believe, echoes more of what has happened in the 30s and 40s with Hitler and the Nazis. Is this something that we've seen before? Is this a tactic that is used time and time again?
Absolutely. If you look back in history, with the Nazis, where initially was annexing the area of the Czech Republic now in pretense that they're a German population, and this is the Russians doing that in Moldova, in Georgia, and now in Ukraine. This is the normal tactic. They at this time they're not going out on the full war. They're trying to instigate things and see how that can get settled. If that doesn't go that way, they go a little bit further until eventually, if need be, they will go to a full war and try to invade Ukraine, which I think is their ultimate goal. So this is something that the Russian aggression destabilizes the world order and also at the same time threatens especially Europe, and trying to bring it back to what the old Soviet Union was. If you remember, Putin several years ago made a remark that the biggest strategy of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Empire. And I think in his mind, I'm pretty sure in his mind that that's exactly what he wants to do, is bring back the glory of the Soviet Union under the Russian banner.
Mm.
So this is what's happening, and I think the world, especially the Western world, has to put a stop to it, because especially Europe, where they're threatened the most, and there are several actions that have been going on throughout. We can discuss that a little bit more in detail. The United States is taking, Europe is taking, through the different sanctions, through the different resolutions in Congress and so forth.
So maybe I'll pass that to you, Irene. Why is Europe so slow on the pull to take action in Ukraine?
Oh, well, can you please elaborate what you mean, why we are so slow?
So,
who are we? What do you
mean? Right. No, well, not necessarily we, but we'll get into the U.S., I think, in a few minutes. But I would think to the rest of the world, it would seem as though the direct stakeholders for something that you are both describing would be Eastern Europe. And is there anything being done in order to stop Putin's advances in Ukraine?
Well, here's the situation. If people take Europe and the United States as two separate entities, we have Germany, France, and Italy in Europe as the most vocal parties. And unfortunately, during the last 20 years, I would say, they became extremely financially tied and economically tied with Russia. So I wouldn't call them friends of Ukraine. And I would say that they're not our friends, they're not Ukrainian friends at all, because during the entire 2014, all the diplomatic actions, negotiations, and tactics which were used, they were useless. The only things that actually worked, it was the drop of price of oil, because Russian economy is actually very shallow, and that's what actually keeps them on top. It's the price of oil. Unfortunately, they supply oil through the European countries. Those economic ties, they do not allow France, Germany, and I would say Italy to be honest on the international political arena. United States, Canada, and Japan, I would say they are Ukrainian friends. First, because they are not dependent on the Russian oil. They don't have so much economic ties. And also, I would say that United States, the strongest country in the NATO. And NATO was created as contemplated to the Soviet regime, and that's why I would say the only country which actually would have the most value on the political arena, that would be the United States, to actually help Ukraine. Because if you would ask me, I would say the Europe, they would stay very very weak in their position to defend Ukraine.
I would like to add a little bit to that.
Please.
And I'll be a little bit critical of Europe itself, even though I was born in Europe. But if you look historically, Europe, each individual country in Europe has never been really aggressive enough to be able to come to the defense of other countries in general. The only thing they do is when the country is directly attacked, then they take some action. You look historically, that's exactly what has been happening. And today, Europeans are no different. They need some sort of a leadership and the only people that can provide leadership are the Americans. The United States has the power and needs to provide the leadership, which I think is lacking, but that's another issue we can discuss later. But so we cannot depend on Europeans. Like Irene mentioned, yes, they're tied very heavily economically, and yes, that's for them it's a bigger burden than for the United States. But sooner or later, they're the ones being threatened, like I mentioned before. And they should take some action and be more proactive in what's happening in their own backyard.
So I know there was demonstrations that were broadcast worldwide in Ukraine recently. You know, over the past few years, you've seen them happen more and more. I believe one of the major events that had happened was the Orange Revolution, as it's known, in 2004. We know it in media as one of the first times that social media was used in order to schedule protests, and a lot of would recommend that would maybe be one of the reasons why it was so successful. Irene, I want your thoughts on where the Ukrainian people stand on things that are going on. And we do have 2 minutes, but we'll pick this conversation up right where we left off when we come back from that. But your thoughts to take us to the break.
Well, I want to really assure you and our listeners listeners that there is no civil war in Ukraine. Mm. What actually happened, Russian invasion on Ukraine started not only last year, but I would say approximately 10 years ago, when pro-Russian president, former president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, came to power, who was actually twice convict. He was convicted two times, and he had no relation to the big politic, and he came to power simply through the connections through Russian and authorities and all kind of using inappropriate methods. Mm-hmm. So he came to power. He actually killed he and his family, people close to his family, they killed, I would say, small and middle business in Ukraine, because everything was basically taken forcefully from people who just become businessmen, who started their businesses, developed their businesses. They went around the world. They learned a little bit. They started to grow their businesses, and was sort of shut down. And Ukraine was brought to the bad economic condition at that point because of the bad economic relationship with Russia, which were imposed by Russia.
Yeah, I just want to add a comment to that. Also, Yanukovych, this was in my thinking, there was a plan from the very beginning with Russia, and this is to basically disarm and demoralize the Ukrainian military, and that's why it's such a sorry state today, where the military is lacking training, is lacking leadership, and weapons. And
absolutely
this was
correct,
a plan
yes.
from the very beginning, and that's the problem today. And Ukrainian military needs a lot of help from that point of view. Yanukovych had a lot to do with that.
Well, we certainly have more to talk about. I'm getting actually lots of texts in for questions and things like that for people that are listening. So maybe we'll address them in our next half hour. But we will be right back with more on the Ukrainian situation. So stay right there for me. Back to It's a New Day, 34 minutes past the hour. Remember to give us a call in at 610-539-8255. We do have some questions coming in. We're going to get to those in a few minutes. But, Irene, I wanted to pick up where you were kind of taking us there as to, what has been going on in the Ukraine. We kind of gave a brief overview of history and some of the things that have happened, but specifically with the corruption within the government in Ukraine. So why don't you continue what we were discussing before?
Well, unfortunately, during last several years, the controlling party was a party of regions, which was sponsored and controlled by Russia. One of the key leaders of the party, Medvedchuk, he is a person who is closely related to Putin. He's actually, Putin is I believe, godfather of his daughter. So they have personal close relation. Ukraine was tied and choked economically because it was forced into very bad economical gas contracts with Russia. There was a huge scandal with the former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who went to prison for several years over those gas contracts. And basically that way, Ukrainian economy, Ukrainian army, Ukrainian system, I would say it just became completely destroyed. People got tired of such a situation because they had a chance, and the chance came up very successfully after the Orange Revolution, and it was shut down. So they were fed up with such a state of affairs, and they came to Maidan. Maidan, it's a central square in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. And in November last year, they started protests, and I can assure you that protests were very peaceful. Unfortunately, the former president, he used power against those protesters, including there were snipers mm-hmm. who were shooting at people, and there were a lot of Ukrainians who were killed, injured in Maidan, and that was the most inhumane, cruel, and improper treatment of expression of freedom mm-hmm. and right to free speech, right to gather, right to, because under the Constitution of Ukraine, people, they hold the power to govern. So the president, he is not a tsar, like mm-hmm. it is traditionally in Russia.
Right.
He is senior executive. He's supposed to listen. He's supposed to take into account what is the power of, what is the will of people of Ukraine. Unfortunately, the situation right now is really terrible. There is no other way to describe it. And there is not just simply like some kind of conflict. It's a war. Mm-hmm. Okay, so according to the Amnesty International, there are about 5,000 Ukrainians who were killed during the last year. It's about, according to the highest commissioner in the UN on the matter of refugees, around 1 million Ukrainians, they are now internally dislocated people.
Mm.
So such areas as Luhansk province, Donetsk province, they're basically destroyed. I cannot even tell you, because the city of Donetsk, it just basically became a nest of terrorists. And I know from the person with whom I spoke, who was a doctor in the state hospital, that those terrorists, they positioned missiles on the territory of local hospitals.
Hmm.
They do it specifically on the local hospitals of the schools, that Ukrainian military forces, they won't be able to respond into that point, because they would know that this is such a strategic object.
That's a typical strategy by all terrorists. They position their weapons in populated areas, so the military tries to counter their attacks, and then they blame the military for killing civilians. That's typical, and they're acting exactly like terrorists in the world do.
Right.
Russia actually claims that this is not terrorists. They're not sponsored by Russia. It's actually pro-Russian Ukrainian citizens who would like to independence. Well, I can assure you it's not correct. Because although I would agree that there is a some percentage of Ukrainians in the East who were pro-Russian, they don't really have such a position that we want to be with Russia, we want to be not with Russia. They wanted peace. And the reason why they were so apolitical, because that area, the reason why I mentioned Holodomor during the 20s, 30s, because those areas, they were the mostly affected by Holodomor. People were dying by thousands. And on their place, a lot of people moved from Russia. So that population of the eastern provinces, what I would say, they don't have those Ukrainian roots. They don't understand Ukrainian culture so much. What they knew Soviet style. Mm. They knew Soviet regime. They were happy when they had their bologna, their bread and butter,
right.
and songs about nice Vladimir Lenin. So that's all what they could remember. This is actually, this is something that Ukrainian government must take into account, because during the last 24 years, I believe they should provide more attention to provide Ukrainian culture, traditions into that area. They were kind of left alone.
Sure.
And I'm not surprised that they are not so much pro-Ukrainian, and rather they see Russia as they had a good life there and didn't think about anything, because everything belonged to everybody.
So that being said, Irene, let's bring it to the U.S. What can be done by the U.S. And I think let's give a clear plan as to what can be done by the U.S. In order to help stop what is going on, or what would you like to see happen?
Well, if I might tell you my first position, I would ask myself as American citizen, why does it matter to U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first, I would like to bring your attention that the United States is a country who is one of the four guarantors of Ukrainian sovereignty under the Budapest Memorandum. What is that? What kind of memorandum is that? After the collapse of Soviet Union, Ukraine was one of the largest countries with the nuclear arsenal.
Mm.
And obviously, United States were not interested to have such a country with such nuclear weapons.
To look at it that way, Roman, what,
yeah.
exactly.
if there were still nuclear weapons in eastern Ukraine today and this had happened...
Yeah, what Irene mentioned during the Budapest Agreement, which was co-signed by United States, Russia, and England, was to disarm Ukraine. Ukraine agreed to do that with the provision that there would be no Russian aggressions on Ukraine, and if there was, there would be the West would come for the defense, especially the United States.
Mm. So, the United States is a
guarantor,
right? A major stakeholder, if you will.
Absolutely. Now, at that time, Ukraine was the third largest nuclear power in the world.
Wow.
Yes, the Russia and the United States were number one and two. Mm. Ukraine was number three. Now, Ukraine volunteered to give up its nuclear weapons. The situation would have been much different. I think, in my opinion, I'll just tell you from the military point of view, what Ukraine should have done. There are different types of nuclear weapons, how you deliver them and the size. There are the strategic, which sit in silos, with long-range rockets that go intercontinental, and they're also tactical that can be fired from artillery or the bombers, just like the Russians are flying right now, mm-hmm. that you might have read yesterday, that the Great Britain complained that there were bombers with nuclear weapons flying over Great Britain several days ago. Those tactical nuclear weapons, the small ones, Ukraine should have held those, and today I think it might have been a little bit different situation because Ukraine could have retaliated with those. That was a mistake done by the Ukrainian administration, basically trusting the West and Russia to have Ukraine get rid of the weapons.
But even outside of that, even having something like that, do you think would bring Putin to the table for talks? You know, having a nuclear arsenal, does that cause more of a peaceful discussion?
No, I would go beyond that. I think that Ukraine having nuclear weapons would have given Putin second thoughts in terms of should I go into Ukraine.
Right.
Because Ukraine with what I was just talking about, Moscow is not that far away. Ukraine could have put a great damage to the Kremlin.
Which is something what Putin does not want.
Absolutely. That would destabilize Russia. Russia in itself is not a very stable country. That would destabilize Russia, and they are afraid of that.
Well, Andrew, coming back to your question, why does it matter? I'm coming back to the matter that the United States are one of the guarantors of Ukrainian sovereignty under that memorandum. And think about, under any kind of law, if there is an agreement, under the agreement there is a country who is a guarantor, there is a duty to protect. So if the United States signed that agreement and they undertook the duty to protect, do we have any kind of honor? Do we have any kind of, even I go beyond legal duty, I go moral duty. You help to disarm some country who give up nuclear weapons voluntarily. You didn't spend any kind of financial to disarm that country. You didn't have any kind of problem with that country. And now that country is basically in danger.
In need.
So isn't it proper to provide help that country is requesting for an entire year?
Absolutely. I can see where you're coming from, and I know that you're both very, very passionate about this, and that really shows. I think in our next segment, if you guys are willing to, we can continue to our discussion on the U.S. involvement in Ukraine and why it may be taking so long. I think, Roman, that's something that you may have pointed out in your introduction. So we are going to head to a commercial break. When we get back, we are going to continue to talk with Roman and Irene about what can be done in Ukraine. Stay with us. Welcome back to It's a New Day, 48 minutes past the hour. We've devoted this entire hour to our lovely guests who have been talking to us about the situation in Ukraine with Russian aggression. And we finally have moved to something that many of you can relate to, which will be what the U.S. is doing and what they can do in order to you know, help the nation of Ukraine, as well as help the beckoning of the two individuals in front of me as well. Roman, this question would be for you. What would you like to see the United States do in defense of Ukraine? Because I think we've hashed away that they need to do something in the defense of Ukraine. But what kind of response would you like to see?
Okay, I'll just go back a few months. Last year in September, there were two things that happened in September. Number one is that Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko came and gave a address to the joint session of Congress, and also afterwards had a meeting with President Obama. Congress fully supported him. President Obama basically would not support him in terms of giving military aid to Ukraine. In fact, with the statement that President Poroshenko made is, you cannot fight the Russian tanks throwing blankets at them. The other thing that happened in September was the Minsk ceasefire agreement, which was signed between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and European Union, basically to cease fire in Ukraine. Since then, nothing except the war was escalated. So there are, again, violations. Russia has, at least of their own, about 10,000 special forces, heavy armor, artillery, anti-tank, radar. They provide training and other things to the terrorists, plus they're doing their own fighting there. Now, the U.S. Congress, which I worked on pieces of this thing last year, wrote a Ukraine Freedom Support Act of 2014, which was overwhelmingly passed by both the House and the Senate and both parties. It went for a signature to President Obama. He signed it and agreed to do that. Basically, the agreement was to provide military, economic, and civil society aid to Ukraine. Since then, President Obama hasn't done anything with it. There is some talk in the news that he might do something. I would be very surprised. What President Obama should do is reverse his single mistake and provide Ukraine with military weapons such as anti-tank, anti-aircraft, and other things. So, also radar, command control, intelligence support. So when you ask me what the United States should do, these are the kind of things the United States should do and President Obama should do, or what he signed and promised he would do.
Irene, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are the following. First, as a country, as United Nations, how do we want to position ourselves in the world arena? Here we have country Russia, who slowly, step by step, taking certain positions. And where does it leave us, United States? Who are we? Are we followers? Are we somewhere in the back? Or we are leaders of the world who actually have our own place and who actually take a leadership in the world political arena. That says if the President Obama has something, a bill which was passed by Congress, and we have a clear congressional intent to help Ukraine, the bill authorized the president to provide military aid, but it specifically stated that the president shall provide the account to the both foreign committees in Congress and Senate. And I believe the date, the due date was February 16. President didn't do anything. So he didn't provide any plan of action. He didn't provide any military assistance. And he's taking very uncertain position. Well, the problem is, as I believe, he doesn't understand Russian mentality. He doesn't understand Putin's mentality, because the main argument is if America would provide any kind of military, defensive, and lethal weapons to Ukraine, it would just escalate the conflict. It's not true, because Russians, they have different mentality than Western countries. And that's what I always say when I speak with people, when I work with people. Mentality issue is the key point. Putin doesn't see all the diplomatic steps and all the actions taken on the diplomatic level as a way to negotiate. He sees it as a weakness. And if United States will not understand it, then we will be considered as a weak country, a country that doesn't have a leadership, that doesn't have a strong position, that doesn't uphold its obligations. Because again, coming back to that Budapest memorandum, we have a legal duty to protect. So if we gave our word and now we are inactive, we don't know what we want to do, maybe we'll consider some aid, maybe we'll not consider, 1 year passed by, where is our position? Well, if the negotiations doesn't help, do not help, if all the agreements reached on the international level failed, because each time when there was agreement reached, Ukrainians, they actually uphold that agreement, and Russians, they didn't stop the fire a single time. Each time Ukrainians had a terrible casualties. And as I said, at this point, we have about 5,000 people killed in Ukraine. So how many more will be killed while political leaders have all those negotiations that go nowhere?
Right. Yeah. And go ahead, Marm.
Yeah, providing military aid to Ukraine would make it to Russia a very costly war. There would be more bodies coming back to Russia through those trucks, quote, coming with humanitarian aid, which we know what they are, as weapons and more troops. And that would again show the Russian population, why are these people dying in a country that we shouldn't be in? There are people like that in Russia, maybe not too many, but especially the mothers of sons that come back in coffins, as it was demonstrated several months ago. I think like Irene mentioned, making the fighting in Ukraine costly to the Russians would make Putin rethink of what the next step should be. He understands force. He doesn't understand diplomacy whatsoever. And in order to make the fighting costly, you have to provide the Ukrainian military with training and weapons, especially weapons that they can use and know how to use. And the other problem that I have a concern in terms of the bureaucracy, especially with the Obama administration, is, and if you look at the, in terms of the Syrian freedom fighters, and if you read the in the papers and so forth, the U.S. aid is trickling in there. It took forever to interview some of the leaders of the movement and then providing weapons. And a very good example is that basically after months and months and months, they provide the Syrian fighters against the regime and ISIS about 16 bullets a month per soldier. Now you can shoot those in less than 1 minute. And this is the kind of aid that the United States, Obama administration provides. And I'm afraid that even if he signs up for something, which he has not, it's going to be just a trickle and take forever.
We don't have much time left, but you bring up an excellent point, Roman, of, you know, with what is going on in Syria and trying to overtake ISIS.
We ought to summarize this to the point that we need to provide military aid to the Ukraine. We need to get NATO ramped up to the point that they're ready for the next step up. We need to get them. This is not the minor leagues here in the Ukraine. This is an area of vital strategic importance. And I would personally suggest that the Ukrainian church, the Catholic Church, conduct talks with the Russian Orthodox Church. It really hurts me to see Christians fighting Christians. And there ought to be consensus there that all these things can be ironed out by diplomatic talks. But in the meantime, we need to be ramping up NATO because the United States can't go in there alone and confront this.
Well, I definitely think there's much more to talk about here, and I really want to thank both of you for coming in this morning and for doing what you're doing, because it sounds like you have a noble pursuit that many more should listen to. I want to thank once again both of you for coming in this morning and talking with us. I want to thank our listeners for letting us broadcast this morning. Tune in tomorrow, 7 to 9, here at 1180 WFYL. Go to 1180WFYL.com. Email us at info@1180 with all of your questions, and we'll make sure that those get answered. From all of us here in the studio, thank you for listening to us today. And as always, please stay informed.